Are protest organizers responsible if a participant breaks the law? A court decision that could have a chilling effect. That's just ahead on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
Plus, a new report on maternal health shows Black Texans are much more likely to die after giving birth. We'll have details. Also, what layoffs at Tesla mean for jobs in Texas and the EV car market. Plus, the Houston Dash celebrates a decade of women's pro soccer. How the team and the league have grown over the years. And getting laughs in the Lone Star State, a look at a comedy festival in Central Texas. We'll talk to one of the comics. All that and more just ahead on the Texas Standard. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 16th of April, 2024. I'm Angela Cocherga. So if a protester breaks the law at a demonstration, can organizers be sued? That's exactly what happened after a Black Lives Matter protest in 2016 in Louisiana. A police officer hit by a rock at the demonstration sued the organizer. A federal judge threw out the case, but the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals let the lawsuit go forward. Civil rights and First Amendment groups warned that could have larger implications for protests. The Supreme Court announced yesterday that it will not hear the case restricting the actions of protest organizers. By declining the case, the court let stand that appeals court ruling, making organizers responsible if any protester commits an illegal act. The lower court ruling covers Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas. Joining us now is Tara Grove, the Vinson and Elkins Chair in Law at the University of Texas School of Law. Professor Grove, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, why did the court choose not to hear this case?
So we never know why the Supreme Court declines to hear a case. A lot of factors go into that decision. It's called granting certiorari. And they typically don't tell us why, and so we're just kind of left to wonder. It does mean that this lower court decision will stand.
Well, can you tell us about the case at issue here?
So a police officer, a rock was thrown at him during a protest by someone, nobody knows who. And what the police officer did was sue the organizer of the protest. And what the Court of Appeals did here was actually try to split the baby a little bit. They said the protest organizer is not liable in what's called in legal terms respondeat superior, which means that just because you're the leader of something, it doesn't mean you're automatically liable for something somebody else does. So they reject that. The protest leader can only be liable for the protest leader's own actions. And what they said was the complaint here, that is, this is all based on just what the police officer alleged at the very early stages. They said the complaint here alleges that the protest organizer was negligent in the way he led the protest. So the Fifth Circuit's decision attempted to be very narrow. I think the concern is that it will not be viewed as very narrow and could actually encourage other lawsuits against protest organizers.
Well, the First Amendment gives citizens the right to protest the actions of the government. Does this ruling seem to conflict with that constitutional guarantee?
So the First Amendment protects speech. The First Amendment does not protect conduct. And so even if you would like to be speaking, you can be civilly sued or criminally prosecuted for your conduct. What's tricky here is it's really hard to separate those two when it comes to an organized protest. I think it's also concerning that here the protest leader is not being sued for anything that he directly did. He did not actually cause the violence. He's being sued for not doing a good enough job of leading the protest. We say in legal terms, negligence. Now, I want to be clear that this is at the very early stages. So if the case went forward and there was actually a jury, it's quite possible that the protest leader could win at the end of the day. But I think the concern here is this could encourage a lot of other people to bring lawsuits against folks who lead protests, could lead people to be a little bit more nervous about leading protests in the first place. And this is something that's kind of at the heart of the First Amendment, chilling speech, making it harder for people to speak because they're nervous about what might happen to them if they do speak.
Well, So the lower court ruling will remain in effect? And what does it mean for activists right now who want to organize a protest in these affected states?
The court's decision is narrow, so it applies in very limited circumstances. The court specifically held that you are not liable just because somebody in your group did something. They rejected respondeat superior liability and accepted a negligence claim. So on the law, one could read this decision as restricting very, very little. But that's not the way the free speech tends to work. People tend to speak more freely when they don't have to worry about hardly any repercussions, or at least not very many repercussions. And so I think there's a genuine concern, no matter what the court said, that people will interpret this decision as kind of granting a license to folks to sue protest organizers, and in turn making it harder for protest organizers to get out there and lead protests against really important matters.
So when would the Supreme Court possibly get involved, and why?
So we don't know for sure. It's possible that if there were a lot of cases like this, there might be a disagreement among the circuits, that is the courts of appeals in the country. And when there's what's called a circuit split, that is the lower courts disagree about an issue, the Supreme Court is more likely to step in. I think what's challenging in this area is that this precise scenario of somebody throwing a rock at a police officer at a protest may not replicate itself precisely throughout the country. And so it may be hard to find a fact pattern that's very similar. And so there might be just a lot of different fact patterns. This might be an extraordinarily rare event too. So I don't know. And I think it's important to recognize that the Supreme Court often doesn't step in even when we expect it to, and even when we think it should, for a variety of reasons that have to do with the institutional concerns of the court. But, you know, I think the bigger concern for this case is the message that it sends to people on the ground in terms of making it a little bit easier to sue protest organizers, and in turn making protest organizers more nervous about leading protests on matters of public concern.
Tara Grove is the Vinson and Elkins Chair in Law at the University of Texas School of Law. Professor Grove, thank you.
Thank you.
Health complications from pregnancy can impact people long after giving birth. When issues like bleeding and postpartum depression are left untreated, they can lead to death. And Black Texans and other groups of color experience maternal mortality at higher rates than their white counterparts. KERA's Elena Rivera reports on efforts to eliminate that disparity. A note for our listeners, this story discusses depression and suicide.
A few months after giving birth, Simone Scott knew something was off.
I had such a dark cloud over me that I was actually even having suicidal thoughts. It was just that bad.
This was her third pregnancy and her toughest. The Dallas resident had been put on bed rest early because she was at high risk of a miscarriage. And when Scott gave birth to her daughter via C-section, she had started bleeding bad.
Hemorrhaging, if I'm not mistaken, that's losing 1,000 units of blood. And that was over 1,300 units. And so I basically almost died on the operating table.
Scott says she was at a breaking point. Then she got connected to the Black-led organization Delighted to Doula. Even though she'd never met the postpartum doula she spoke with, she felt safe.
I felt so much better after that initial session that my milk production actually tripled. That was the first time that I actually felt heard.
The health issues Scott experienced, bleeding, postpartum depression, are two of the most common reasons Texans die in pregnancy. Texas is among the worst states in the country for maternal mortality. Part of why outcomes are bad is because it's hard for people to access care. Until recently, pregnant Texans on Medicaid only got 2 months of postpartum coverage. A new extension in March bumped it to 12 months. And on top of that, there are disparities in who experiences these issues. Black pregnant Texans die at 2 to 3 times the rate of their white counterparts.
I definitely think that things are getting worse. The needle is definitely moving in a way that we don't want it to.
That's Brandi Green, a clinical assistant professor at the University of Texas at Arlington, who researches maternal and child health. She says Black maternal mortality is also high because of
systemic racism. So in the hospital system, we still see there's a difference in how women are treated based on their race, ethnicity. And so that's another thing that we're fighting with.
Jay Fields has seen that in her own work as a doula and as part of the Maternal Health Equity Collaborative. It's a Central Texas group working for birth justice and advocacy. She says finding joy in pregnancy instead of fear is about centering people in their birth decisions.
Because it's their bodies and it's their birth, and they may have various reasons beyond the medical of why they want to make a decision. Because another big reason, like when it comes to birth trauma, we're seeing is not always the actions of what happened in the birth per se, but how the person felt about their birth.
Field says birth trauma can also include feeling dismissed or talked down to. A 2019 national study in the Journal of Reproductive Health found Black and other pregnant people of color were twice as likely as white patients to report a doctor ignored them and refused their request for help. She says doctors need training on racism and equity so all patients feel supported.
You may be desensitized because you do this all day, but for the person sitting in front of you, they don't. And so they need to feel comfortable. They need to feel heard.
That's what Simone Scott found at Delighted to Doula. A little while after she connected with the nonprofit, she started working there, doing client outreach.
I'm sorry.
I don't have a room for you, but
okay.
Your laptop, though.
Scott says now she gets to give back, encouraging pregnant people to reach out for help before a health issue becomes a crisis.
This literally saved my life. That dark cloud. You never know when someone is going through that. What could really happen?
For resources and support, call or text 1-833-TLC-MAMA to reach the National Maternal Mental Health Hotline or 988 to reach the National Suicide Hotline. I'm Elena Rivera in Dallas.
Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, joins us now with the Talk of Texas. Hi, Wells.
Hi, Angela. Great to be with you this Tuesday. Well, new developments in Texas' long-running court battle over the failures of its foster care system. A federal judge is imposing a $100,000 a day fine against the state for failing to fix its problems with the foster system. The order from Judge Janice Jack against Health and Human Services officials came after court monitors detailed numerous abuses in how Texas handles youth in state care. On X, John Folks tweets, "It's so sad that Texas did not take care of its children, especially those in the foster care system." Also via X, Buta Mojo tweets their perspective, "Especially in light of the state's ban on most abortions. Isn't Texas a so-called save the baby state, but not this age of babies? There's no way to fix this without further reform to the foster care system," he says. Just a couple of the responses we're seeing out there today. I'll be back with more stories from social media later in the show.
Thank you, Will. Wells, we'll look forward to that.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, right here with cancer care at more than 280 locations around Texas, allowing patients to remain close to family, friends, and caregivers while they fight against cancer. More at TexasOncology.com.
This is a Texas Standard. I'm Angela Cocherga. Dallas actor-singer Cedric Neal gained acclaim for his performances in North Texas musicals. Now he's acclaimed in England as well. KERA's Jerome Weeks reports that though he didn't win, Neal was up for London Theatre's highest honor, an Olivier Award.
A song that comes late in a musical and is meant to wake up the audience? That's called an 11 o'clock number. And the musical, Guys and Dolls, has arguably the greatest 11 o'clock number. Sit down, you're rocking the boat. That's Cedric Neal leading it.
For the people, all sit down, you're rocking the boat.
But as much as anything, it's this singing that got Neal cast.
Thank the Lord.
That got Londoners on their feet and got him nominated for Best Supporting Actor in a Musical for the British equivalent of the Tony Award. Neal's been singing black church music like that since he was 4 in Oak Cliff. In Guys and Dolls, he plays Nicely Nicely Johnson, a nervous nebbish who finally cuts loose in a storefront church.
He's one of the most beloved characters in musical theater. And here comes me, this black actor who infuses gospel in everything he does. And I thought, they're not going to accept that.
British directors had told Neil, scale it back. But Nicholas Heitner, the director of Guys and Dolls, told Neil, we know who we hired. Give us Cedric. One reason Heitner might well know Neil's vocal talents was that Neil took a calculated risk to raise his profile. Back in 2019, he auditioned for the UK version of The Voice, the popular TV singing contest.
My agent and I went back and forth. Do we do this? Is it too commercial? But it would be another way to elevate your profile. And I'm so glad I did it.
Neil was certainly known in London theater. In 2011, he left Dallas for New York. He snagged his first Broadway musical as an understudy in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. 3 years later, when that show was being staged in London, Neil got cast. But before he could tell his then-fiancée about it, his fiancée told Neil his firm had just promoted him to London. So the move to England in 2014 was an easy choice. But even when Neil was already cast in a major show, finding acceptance there wasn't easy.
I'm not going to lie. It was tough because for the longest time, I didn't know how Americans were viewed in the theater world over here.
American actors are often seen as poaching British jobs.
But when they realized that I was staying and this was home, it changed.
Still, appearing on The Voice would tell a lot more people England is home and that he's a formidable singer. Spoiler, Neil didn't get past the semifinals. But 8 million viewers of The Voice telecast saw his audition with Stevie Wonder's Higher Ground. And on YouTube, it's been viewed more than 3 million times. Neil gets choked up talking about how much he owes Booker T. Washington Arts Magnet High School, as well as his fellow members of the Dallas Theater Center Acting Ensemble.
I would be nothing if it wasn't for Dallas. And I'm just proud to represent not only Black American musical theater, but Dallas theater.
I'm Jerome Weeks in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to protecting Texas employers by investigating fraud and focusing on preventing abuse of the system. More at texasmutual.com/fraud.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
My name is Jessica Charla. I'm an associate professor of instruction in the Division of Textiles Apparel at UT Austin, and you're listening to Texas Standard. So today, we're previewing the exhibition Particles of Color, Where Science Meets Fashion at the Texas Science and Natural History Museum. And this is all about sustainable sequins and looking back a little bit at the history in terms of the types of sequins that are going to be displayed throughout the exhibition. But really, it's a celebration of the different designers and artists that we have collaborating in the space to showcase how they would use this new material in their own genres through their own lens. So here, as you move through, you'll see just the different kind of substances in different forms. You've got the clear bioplastic pellets, and then mica powders and the sheets that we create, and then all of the punchinella, which is the waste that's created, we melt down again. And so it, in fact, is a zero waste process. We can keep utilizing these materials into different sheets and molds. I worked and lived in New York for 8 years, and so I had a very kind of commercial capitalist perspective of fashion. And when I got burnt out of that, I went to Italy and did a master's there and had a whole shift in terms of how I was creating things and how I was designing things. My whole shift in identity changed, where I took a look at what am I doing and what am I contributing and how is this going to make the world a better place for my kids. And that's when I started looking into sustainable fashion. So since then, it's been since I started working at UT in 2015, I've been really diving into this research in terms of where are we headed? What is the impact that we've had on our planet globally? And what are the choices that we can make to make a shift and to hopefully solve that problem? So I've really been working not only regionally, but globally with other researchers and with other fashion brands who are like-minded and trying to change the industry so it can kind of slow down and just be more intentional in terms of what we're doing, what we're making, and what we're creating and putting out there into the world. So the goal was to look at what types of waste are out there that we could utilize to turn into a new sequin that could be composted and wouldn't be a detriment to the environment if they were to end up in the landfill. And when this project originated through the 2019 President's Award for Global Learning, I worked with a scientist and told him, basically, what is out there? Let's look at the landfill, let's look at waste that's being created that we can utilize so we can replace any sort of petroleum-based plastic sequin that exists. And he recommended polylactic acid because it's derived from agricultural waste. So this is our version of a plant-based plastic derived from agricultural waste, such as corn. It's scalable. It could be easily commercialized and used as a substitute to any sort of petroleum-based plastic. This is the science behind fashion design, and this is how we can work together to create an even more responsible product for the end consumer, one that can maybe solve a problem too. I'm Jessica Charla, and you're listening to Texas Standard.
All this week, we're bringing you stories leading up to our hour-long special. The Future of Work in Texas is coming on Monday. We're exploring how changing technology and population patterns might affect Texas industries. You can learn more and share your thoughts now at texasstandard.org.
Support for Texas Standard's Future of Work in Texas comes from Talru's Ready, Set, Hire. Serving Central Texas hiring needs, one employer and one job seeker at a time. Job search and recruiting tools available at ReadySetHire.com. And from Goodwill Central Texas, providing one-on-one career guidance, professional certifications, job placement assistance, and employer connections to Central Texans in need. Details at GoodwillCentralTexas.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Alexandra Hart. A new survey finds former President Donald Trump with a double-digit lead over President Joe Biden in the November general election. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider says that lead holds regardless of whether independent Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is an option in Texas.
The Texas Hispanic Policy Foundation polled likely registered voters on their top choice under two scenarios. One if Kennedy's on the Texas ballot, one if he isn't. In both cases, Trump holds a 12-point lead over Biden, according to Rice University Baker Institute fellow Mark Jones.
While there's a 12% lead now for Trump, when we look at some of the undecided voters, they tend to lean more Democratic than Republican. So if Biden can mobilize those individuals to actually turn out, when they turn out, they should vote for him and for fellow Democrats.
Critically, the survey shows Trump leading among one group that favored Biden 4 years ago, women. The survey finds 44% of women voters supporting Trump compared to 34% for Biden and 10% for Kennedy. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Next week marks 2 years since Rio Grande Valley woman Melissa Lucio was granted a stay from her planned execution. Lucio was accused of killing her 2-year-old daughter Mariah in 2007. In a rare move, both the defense and prosecution are calling for Lucio's release from prison. Texas Public Radio's Gage Davila has more.
The state's highest criminal appeals court will decide whether Melissa Lucio should be exonerated after 17 years in prison. The county DA and Lucio's attorneys had agreed 16 months ago that favorable evidence was withheld in her murder trial. That evidence was testimony from Lucio's children, who said Mariah had fallen down the stairs of the family's apartment complex and Melissa had cared for her up until she died. Cameron County District Court Judge Arturo Nelson said in a statement that Lucio, quote, met her burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence that she would not have been convicted in light of the suppressed evidence. I'm Gage Davila in McAllen.
Kansas City Chiefs wide receiver Rashee Rice is being sued for at least $10 million after a six-vehicle collision last month. As KERA's Megan Cardona reports, Southern Methodist University football player Teddy Knox is also included as a defendant.
Two Dallas residents claim Rice and Knox drove well over the 70-mile-per-hour speed limit before crashing on North Central Expressway in Dallas. Court documents say Rice and Knox hit a median and set off a high-speed chain collision with four other commuters. Now, two people who were in one of the hit cars are seeking no less than $10 million in damages. The two Dallas residents are also asking for a jury trial. I'm Megan Cardona in Fort Worth.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Aspire Allergy and Sinus, providing same-day results and custom treatment plans to tackle allergies at the root of the problem. Over 40 locations throughout Texas. More info at aspireallergy.com.
33 minutes past the hour. I'm Angela Cocherga. The Houston Dash played their first ever National Women's Soccer League game a decade ago in April 2014. They played then defending league champions, the Portland Thorns. The Dash has not always had the most impressive record. They made it to the playoffs for the first time in their 10-year history in 2022. The program has grown a lot since the early days. And here to tell us more about a decade of the Houston Dash is Theo Lloyd Hughes, who wrote about this topic for Squad Depth. Theo, welcome back.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
For this story, you spoke to Kelia Watt, a former Dash player, now a sideline analyst for Amazon Prime's National Women's Soccer League. What did she have to say about the early days of the team compared to how things are looking now for players?
Yeah, it was a real full circle moment. It was amazing talking to her about being back in Houston, back in the NWSL in 2024. And in those 10 years, it's kind of hard to get your head around just how much things have changed. Something in particular she talked about was when they were, you know, at the training center in 2014, there were no locker rooms. They all had porta potties, essentially. You'd go to the bathroom in there, you'd change your outfits in there. Sometimes you'd go home in your dirty training uniform. And the players were then expected to wash their own uniforms as well. The compensation back then, you know, for a rookie player could be about $7,000 for the season. You know, now the minimum in the league is $37,000. So there are big concrete changes both in, you know, how they were training, how they were being treated, and how they were being compensated.
Yeah, some major changes. Well, can you walk us through how the league as a whole has grown and changed over the last 10 years?
This offseason, so a few months ago, the NWSL signed a new broadcast deal with Amazon, ESPN, CBS, and the Scripps Network. It's worth $60 million a year, and it's probably the biggest women's league broadcast in the world. And so what we're seeing is, like Amazon on Friday night, we're seeing so much more access, so many more cameras, so much more coverage of the game grow. And in turn, that's creating a more exciting league, a better product, more investment for the players, more resources into stuff like sports science. And that's just boosting the whole quality. So I would say, you know, this new broadcast deal in the American League is huge. And we're seeing the results of that in real time. The other big thing is the league's first collective bargaining agreement in 2022. That guaranteed better contracts, better treatment, and more safe access for the players. Surrounding sports science and coaching, rules and regulations for what is expected for professional athletes. And that CBA in 2022 really was the landmark for kind of getting the league to where it is today.
Yeah, well, to elaborate a little more, what does it mean for players and fans, for the Dash and other NWSL teams to have better working conditions and playing conditions than they did in the beginning?
Well, I think, you know, injuries could be something we look at when we talk about the quality of pitches. Some games used to be in baseball stadiums, you know, and they'd have to cover up the diamond and wheel in extra grass. And I think not only does that, you know, it jeopardize the health and safety of the players, it creates a worse product, right? If you can't move the ball around, if you can't score great goals and you can't put those goals on an HD camera and share them around the world, how are you going to grow this league? So it can be as simple as making sure that there are standards written in place in the league to say, these are the stadiums we expect. This is the surface we expect. And then once you get, you know, great surfaces and the players are healthy and fans can really see the game, then you broadcast that game around the world and you show how talented these athletes are. So again, you know, the transformation we've seen is we always had great athletes, some of the best female soccer players in the world play in the United States. But now we're giving them the right resources to make them happy, keep them safe, keep them compensated, attract the best talents in the world once you see those salaries go up. And now people can watch it, you know, in their homes and around the world.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I know different broadcast entities are streaming different parts of the league this year, and it's a little bit of a hodgepodge. So, but if somebody wants to watch the Dash play, how can they do that?
Well, I think, you know, for those in Texas, especially in the Houston area, you can try going to a game as well. Tickets can range from anywhere from $12 to maybe $50. There's a lot of different price points there. But in terms of streaming, you know, what we're seeing is Friday nights on Amazon. So that's Amazon Prime Video streaming. That's a big kind of viewpoint. And then Saturdays is going to be on the Ion Network and Scripps, which are over the air and streaming free channels. And then Sunday, ESPN slash ESPN2, ESPN sort of family of networks. They then often host a game on Sunday. And the other games will be picked up by NWSL Plus, which is a free streaming service hosted on NWSLsoccer.com. So the games are very accessible, albeit they are quite spread out across the networks. CBS also has 10 games this season that they will be showing on their network as well.
We've been speaking to Theo Lloyd-Hughes, who writes about women's soccer. His latest piece was on 10 years of the Houston Dash for squad depth, and we'll have a link over at texasstandard.org. Theo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, working towards a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Michael Marks. When people think of comedy, they often first think of New York or Los Angeles or Chicago. These are cities that have improv scenes, big creative communities, a lot of opportunities to get noticed. Well, what about Austin? There's a growing comedy community here in the capital city, which hosts the annual Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Jeff Hiller is a comedian who's been in the industry for more than two decades and worked on shows like 30 Rock, Community, and most recently, the critically acclaimed HBO series Somebody Somewhere. He's also a San Antonio native who recently made a trip back to his home state for the Moon Tower Fest. Jeff, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. It feels good to be back in Texas.
It feels good to have you. How would you describe your comedy when you're on stage, not when you are performing on the screen?
I think I would be considered an alt comic. I lean more into storytelling and just mining stuff from my life. Don't say anything around me that you don't want on stage because I will take it.
So what was it like growing up in San Antonio? How did that inform your career as it stands now, if it did?
Well, you know, I think, I mean, I spent my entire childhood here, so yeah, it must have informed me somewhat, right? I think that one of my jokes in my stand-up is San Antonio, it's a great place to visit, but I wouldn't want to grow up gay there in the 80s.
Bad luck, huh?
I stand by that joke.
I mean, can you give me a little sense about, I don't know, just what was it like there in the 80s? If you close your eyes and put yourself back, what's it feel like?
Don't make me close my eyes and put myself back. What is this, therapy? I think it, you know, I am sort of flippant about it, but it was difficult to be different. I'm sure it would probably be difficult to be different anywhere. But, you know, I was growing up in a place that, you know, worships football on Friday nights. And I was like, what about choir concerts? And they were like, no, thanks.
Right. Well, when did you know that you wanted to pursue making people laugh?
Well, it took me a long time. It was much easier to come out as gay than as a comedian. because everybody knew I was gay. Nobody knew I wanted to be a comedian. The thing I did was I was a social worker for a few years. In Denver, Colorado, and I started doing improv on the side, which is like I was like the coworker that you're like, oh God, he's going to ask me to come to his improv show. And it was, you know, the first taste was free. And then I really went in all depth and was just a real hardcore improviser. And and then eventually started doing stand-up too.
What was it about improvisation that lit up your brain?
Well, it is, I mean, people like to make fun of improv, rightly so, but it is an art form, and it's something that is fast and exciting and fun, and it's this thing that you can't do by yourself. You have to have somebody else with you. And you don't even need an audience, but you do need another partner.
Sure.
To come up with something that you could never come up with on your own, but you and your partner could come up with something fascinating and interesting. And I love that communal aspect of it. And I love the quickness of it and the fastness of it and the fact that you can play a cockroach or a rock and do something that you would never be cast in on television, let's say. There's a freedom there that you don't necessarily get with acting. And I love that. I love improv for that.
That's much different from stand-up, though. I mean, the inherently collaborative nature of improv, along with the fact that, with stand-up, presumably, you're performing a routine that you have practiced a lot of these beats and jokes. I mean, is that an accurate characterization? Can you tell me a little bit about how you approach them because of their differences?
Yeah, I you do have to write stand-up, which is why I started it much later than I did improv.
Sounds like a lot more work.
It is. Oh my God, it's a pain. Improv shapes it too. Like a lot of times I'll improvise something on stage and then keep that for future performances. But my stand-up is almost like therapy. I don't mean to say that if you come, I'm just going to whine at you for an hour.
Sure,
but it's a wonderful way to process the world, and so it's, I don't know. I mean, if I'm going to get really deep, I'm going to tell you it's good for my mental health. But also, you know, fart jokes, it's good too.
Fart jokes are also good for your mental health from time to time.
That is very true. I subscribe to that theory.
What's it like coming back to Texas to perform?
It was great. It was like I was getting married to myself because afterwards, when I went out after the show, it was like, people from my college and one of my old babysitters and,
it almost sounds like a
choir teacher.
It almost sounds like a Tom Sawyer funeral.
Yes, it was a Tom Sawyer funeral. And, let me tell you, mine's going to be great. And there's going to be a lot of people there. Okay.
Well, is there anything that you find yourself wanting to talk about more when you come home or maybe the opposite, subjects you perhaps want to avoid?
Well, that is the thing. When I do this show in front of an audience of people who I don't know, it's much easier because some of these stories that I'm telling in this particular show, people who are in those stories are in the audience. And I find that very stressful.
That's tough.
But, you know, nobody yelled. So I guess it all ended up great in the end.
what's on your plate now? Tell me about the projects that you're working on.
Well, I'm going to continue to tour this show. And I shot season 3 of Somebody Somewhere, which will be coming out sometime in the near future. Lots of irons in the fire. We'll see.
Like you said, you came down here for the Moon Tower Comedy Festival in Austin. Do you perceive any changes in the comedy scene writ large in Austin?
I think so. I feel like there's improv theaters here. There's a lot more stand-up clubs than I remember, even growing up in the 80s, when there was the stand-up boom. I feel like there was sort of one or two clubs, and now there's, you know, nights at different venues and also dedicated stand-up clubs. And I think that people are also not afraid to try different types of comedians and different types of comedy. And I think none more so than Austin. You know, Austin is the city in Texas that's willing to try it all. And I appreciate them for that.
That's what they like to think.
Keep it weird.
Well, you can catch comedian Jeff Hiller on stage or on screen in Somebody Somewhere. Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU Neely, hosting the Global Supply Chain Summit about AI, with a keynote address from Keurig Dr. Pepper, April 24th. More at tcu.edu/scsummit.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Angela Cocherga. Signs of turmoil at Tesla continued yesterday after the company told employees it would lay off more than 10% of the workforce to cut costs. Two senior executives also resigned. The job cuts amount to about 14,000 people across the company's global operations. That will be felt in Austin, where Tesla is one of the biggest employers. Here to tell us more is Bob Seckler, the assistant managing editor at the Austin Business Journal. Bob, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to the layoffs, can you give us a sense of how many people Tesla employs in Austin and in the Austin area, and what kind of jobs do they do?
Well, I mean, right now, at the end of 2023, they employed just under 23,000 people at the plant in eastern Travis County. They're also building facilities in Buda and Kyle, and so they employ more than that, than the 23,000 or so. But the bulk of them are in the new plant, and that's where their headquarters is as well.
Well, do we have any sense of how the announced layoffs will impact folks in the Austin area?
Well, we know that people have been laid off, we've heard from upwards of a dozen. What we don't know is the magnitude in terms of whether that 10% figure, which, by the way, was more than 10%, Elon Musk said in his company memo. We don't know if that will, if that's what we will see in Austin. I mean, you could, if we did see that, that would be more than 2,000 people. But you also could think that since we're a hub, and one of the reasons he gave was to reduce redundancies around the world, that maybe he would not cut as deeply in Austin.
And do we have a sense of what kind of jobs are at stake here in the Austin area?
Well, I mean, in his memo, he just said overlapping functions. But I mean, just from seeing the people who announced basically on social media that they had been laid off, they seem to run the gambit of positions. I mean, we had people in software, people in software development, people in engineering. We had people business development say they had been laid off. And, you know, that's obviously not just in Austin. We saw people posting on social media they've been laid off in California and Nevada. So these are widespread layoffs, and they don't appear at this point to be targeted at one area of the company.
Yeah, so globally, what's causing the financial problems at Tesla?
Well, what Elon Musk, the explanation he gave was that they had grown so fast that they had all these redundancies that they had to cut. But it's hard to look at that and not in the context of the fact that the EV sales of electric vehicles have been slowing. They have been slowing from a very rapid pace over the past few years. There's also been price cuts in the industry. And so Tesla's, just recently, they reported their first quarter deliveries. They were down year over year. They declined for the first time in about 4 years. Their margins are under pressure. They also are under pressure to come out with new models. So, I mean, there are clearly some struggles in the industry that Tesla is having to deal with.
So what are those possible fallouts from this layoff news in the wider EV and car industry?
Well, I mean, Tesla is a leader in EV sales and obviously it's a sign that that EV sales are slowing. I don't think they're going away. I mean, I think we have to put it in context that this was a very fast growing segment of the car industry, and I believe it is still growing overall. It's just not growing as fast. So that's a big difference than no one's buying EVs or something. I still think people are buying EVs, and I think that will continue.
We've been speaking to Bob Seckler, the assistant managing editor at the Austin Business Journal. Bob, thank you for making time for the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, is back, and he's monitoring the talk of Texas. Hi, Wells.
Howdy, Angela. Well, as we were just hearing, lots of questions in the Central Texas region over what this massive amount of layoffs that Tesla has announced will mean, especially with the electric vehicle being headquartered in Austin and recently being named the region's highest private employer, largest private employer in Austin. Whether or not that's going to hold after these layoffs remains to be seen. Interesting reactions we're seeing out there on Twitter. Fox 7 Austin reporter Carissa Lemkuhl tweeted that she spoke to some Gigafactory employees where they assembled the Cybertruck, were sent notices essentially overnight that they were being terminated. She tweets, "Some showed up to work this morning confused when their badges didn't work." So that's one aspect we're looking at here. Another one, more interesting, on a related note, looking at the sort of higher executive layoffs, Mu Robi notes that several Tesla top lieutenants at the company have departed as well. Mu Robi, love that Twitter name there, says, "We're now back to relying on Elon taking the time away from his conspiracy theories to give any info or updates on Tesla." And of course, this company is its products, and there's lots of discussion about what the Cybertruck's role may be with regard to things going on at the automaker there. The tech website The Verge notes that Tesla has delayed several Cybertruck deliveries. They haven't made any sort of official comment. But folks in the Cybertruck Owners Club forum have reported receiving texts or calls telling them their deliveries were being rescheduled. One user said they'd been told by the dealer that the truck was recalled over its accelerator pedal. Again, no official recall or statement from the company, but this comes, Angela, on the heels of this incredible video I saw on X yesterday of someone describing how essentially part of their accelerator foot pedal had become loosened and essentially wedged under the console of the car, meaning that the thing was going full tilt, full blast speed until this driver realized what was going on and was safely able to disable it. So, of course, we've seen lots of discussion about other aspects of the Cybertruck. So, a couple. I'm surprised to say there's actually two in my neighborhood. It's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy, Angela.
I have not seen one.
Yes, not as many Cybertrucks in El Paso as there are in Austin. Developing story here regarding the automaker that folks are watching pretty closely. You know, something I was talking about yesterday, star testing here for many students across Texas. I got my little guy taking the fourth grade test today. Pamela McKellar Johns is sounding off on her Facebook page. She says, "I'm thinking our state leaders need to provide an extensive infusion of money into our public schools to allow them to adequately educate our next generation of leaders." Yeah, many folks not enamored with this so-called teaching to the test. But as I hear the music there, I think it's probably time for me to wrap things up with you here, Angela.
Yeah, we're out of time for today's program, but you can keep up with the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org. I'm Angela Cocherga, wishing you all the very best from El Paso.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Venture Vault, with a reminder that U.S. companies are now required to file beneficial owner information with FinCEN. Learn more about the new requirements at venture-vault.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.